Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. Judge Legault and I are pleased to welcome our colleague from the Middle District of Alabama, Judge Keith Watkins, to assist us today and tomorrow. He's filling in for Judge Beverly Martin, who would have been sitting with us, but Judge Martin, as many of you may know, has decided to retire, and we wish her well, and we very much appreciate Judge Watkins filling in this week to assist us with our work. Judge Watkins is a former chief judge of the Middle District and is now a senior district judge. Senior judges perform about 20% of the workload of the federal judiciary. Really, we really couldn't do our work without them. They provide an invaluable service, and they're a bargain. They work for free. So thank you, Keith, for helping us this week.
My pleasure.
Counsel, we're familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs, the authority cited in your briefs, at least portions of the record. So you have limited time this morning. I apologize for the delay. We're having video difficulties with our live stream today, so we're just live streaming audio. Judge Lagoa has had a little bit of background noise, which is why she's muted now. But if she asks a question, she'll unmute, or I'll have to remind her to unmute if she forgets. But that's why she's muted at this point. So our first case this morning, by the way, pay attention to the clock. When the clock expires, it is time to wrap it up. If you're answering a question from the court, feel free to finish your answer, but be mindful of our time. Our first case this morning is CSX versus the United States. This is a return trip to our court. Mr. Killian, will you start, please?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Brian Killian on behalf of the appellants. As you noted, Judge Pryor, 3 years ago in the CSX 1 decision, this court examined the plain language of the Railroad Retirement Tax Act and held, quote, relocation benefits and moving expenses that comport with the statutory requirements of E1III are excluded from railroad retirement tax. On remand, the district court found on the undisputed evidence that the relocation benefits at issue in this appeal do in fact comport with E1III's statutory requirements. Yet we're here again on appeal because the government insists that income tax deduction rules apply on top of E1III's statutory requirements. So whether today we're going to talk-
I think we might be here in part because there was some confusing language in the previous panel decision about substantiation. I'm wondering what you think the panel meant when it referred to substantiation in its opinion. Is it just the statute refers to the employer identifying certain reimbursements? Is that the substantiation you think that was? Hold on one moment, Miss. Please stop the clock. Brian?
I've stopped it, John.
We had another lawyer from another case who appeared on screen for a moment. Is that rectified?
Yes, Ron, I stopped the video.
Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Killian.
Sure, and I understand Your Honor's question. The district court did say, interpreted CSX 1 as not foreclosing application of the accountable plan rules in this case. When this court used the phrase substantiation in CSX 1, it was in fact referring to E1III's requirement of employers separately paying or separately identifying the amounts that are covered by E1III. Substantiation is not a term of art for when employees give receipts to their employers. Rather, substantiation is a general term that describes how private individuals document the existence of a transaction that has income tax or employment tax ramifications. And so historically, there are two methods of substantiation in a reimbursement context. The employer can substantiate by making separate payments or separately identifying as payments, or the employee can substantiate by providing the receipts to the employer for those reimbursements. So, you know, the district court.
It's a strange use of the word, would you agree?
Well,
it seems like perhaps the better word from your, if you're right, is identification, the identification requirements, referred to substantiation. I don't know what substantiates beyond just identifying.
Well, there's also you could also separately pay. So separately identify is only one half of the phrase within E1III. So even just saying an identification requirement
wouldn't substantiate it.
Well, I think it does, Your Honor, in this regard. You know, historically, up until the accountable plan rules came out into the late 1980s, employers, in fact, substantiated their reimbursements in exactly this method. And so if the IRS had a question after the fact about whether an amount was a reimbursement or whether an amount was wages, they would go back and look at the pay stub, and that would substantiate the claim that it was in fact a reimbursement. And so I do think it's fair to call it substantiation in that general sense.
Is the use of the word substantiation there, it's really you're proving whatever the expense is, that either it qualifies or it doesn't qualify.
It proves that the payment was made. Yes, Your Honor. It proves that this was done in accordance with the statutory requirements.
Mr. Killian, is anything that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can I ask you a question? Does the mandate in CS1, does it foreclose the government's argument that Section 162A's ordinary and necessary business expense framework should apply to the RRTA compensation as defined by 3231E1?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. In CSX1, the government and CSX litigated over the scope of the statutory language, whether it included relocation benefits and moving expenses or whether it did not. The government argued it did not because the government's view was that the language in the statute is limited to travel expenses. We argued, and the court agreed, that you follow the plain language of E1III. And now the government has come back with this 162A argument, which directly contradicts the statute, the holding of this court. And I'll read it again. Statute relocation benefits and moving expenses that comport with the statutory requirements of E1III are excluded. This court did not identify Section 162A. In fact, the government didn't even identify 162A itself in the briefs, really up until December of last year. But nonetheless, this court's authoritative interpretation of the words in the statute does foreclose the 162A argument that the government raises today. If the court accepted the 162A argument that the government proposes, then relocation benefits and moving expenses would never be excluded under E1III. And so there is
not sure that the prior panel really decided that. I think it's clear that Judge Jordan thought that was an unpersuasive argument, but it wasn't something the panel actually decided, was it?
I'll agree, Your Honor, that the government did not identify Section 162A in its briefing to this court in the CSX1 case. But I do think that the court's authoritative interpretation of the statutory language effectively forecloses the Section 162A argument. And so the 162A argument is, if not an attack on the holding of CSX1, an attack on the reasoning and the stare decisis effect of CSX1. For the two reasons, as I just tried to answer to Judge Lagoa, this court, there would be a functional incompatibility. If the 162A argument is right, then CSX1 is a dead letter. And number two, this court identified all the statutory requirements when it said that CSX needs to comply with the statutory requirements of E1III, and 162A was not one of those. But even if CSX1 didn't foreclose the 162A argument, the Supreme Court's decision in Central Illinois does also foreclose that argument. In Central Illinois, which was decided in 1978, just 2 years after E1III was added into the RRTA, the government, in dealing with an income tax withholding regulation that is nearly identical, it's not exactly the same, but nearly identical to the language that's in E1III, told the Supreme Court that this language in the income tax withholding reg incorporates a 162A deductibility requirement. And the Supreme Court said no. The Supreme Court said there is not an express link between these two and recognized rightly that a withholding exclusion administered by employers at the time wages are paid to employees is fundamentally different from an income tax deduction that is applied by the employees months, maybe even more than a year later when the employee is doing his taxes for April 15th. And so as the Supreme Court said, required withholding is rightly much narrower than subjectibility to income taxation. The government tries to argue that Central Illinois is somehow compatible with the 162A argument, but we don't see it. And we think that the plain reading of the court's decision there forecloses that argument. There is no explicit link between E1III and 162A. When Congress wants explicitly to link one of the RRTA provisions to a different provision in the Internal Revenue Code, it does so by cross-reference. And indeed, there are several other RRTA exclusions that specifically cross-reference other provisions in the Internal Revenue Code in order to synchronize one exclusion in the RRTA with an exclusion somewhere else in the code. E1III, however, is entirely self-contained. As this court, I think, held in CSX1, its provisions are clear and complete. There is no reason to look into the internal, the income tax provisions of the Internal Revenue Code in order to understand what E1III encompasses. Nor is there an implicit link, as the government suggests, because the wording here is not identical. Really, this is the court were to apply this, it'd be through the in pari materia canon, where courts will construe two identically worded statutes similarly if their purposes are similar. But here the wording is not identical. And as the Supreme Court said in Central Illinois, the purposes are not similar either. They're not harmonious because one is an exclusion administered by employers and the other is a deduction administered by the employer.
One is statutory and the other was regulatory too. That's an odd way of to take the government's argument, transplanting old soil.
Exactly. When Congress wrote E1III, it tailored it to the railroads. It did not simply lift even the FICA language that it had said that it liked the style of the old FICA exclusion. It added an express reference to allowances because railroads historically have provided railroad employees with all manner of allowances. And the IRS's revenue ruling that precipitated the enactment of E1III was a direct threat to the railroad's provision of allowances. The Congress also changed the adjectives that limit or apply to the types of business expenses that E1III covers. And so even if there were some ancient connection, as the government surmises, you know, that the DNA of E1III is inherited from 162A, over time and by Congress's direct writing of E1III, it severed that link between the two. The government's argument... Yes, sir.
Mr. Killian, I have a more fundamental question about the interplay between audit procedures and substantiation. Does it matter what type of, does anything here preclude the IRS from auditing any tax situation, no matter what substantiation applies? What's the interplay as a practical matter between substantiation and audit? Is there any prejudice to the IRS here?
No, when the IRS wants to check later on to see whether CSX and its employees properly withheld the RRTA tax, it has the full power of its auditing powers to request documents and to ensure that the E1III statutory requirements were satisfied at the time the payment was made. The audit does not allow the IRS to impose additional requirements or to change the type of substantiation that E1III itself prescribes. But yes, the IRS...
Yeah, but of course, the problem here is that these amounts weren't withheld. Sought a refund.
They were withheld, and we did seek the refund.
Well, yeah, exactly. Right. You did not exempt them from withholding and then realize that you thought you should have, and then you sought a refund, right?
That's correct. Although I point out that the CSX There are more than just one tax year at issue here. While this case involves only 2009, CSX has been providing relocation benefits to its employees for the greater part of the last decade. And if I may finish answering this question, there are 10 more years approximately worth of cases that are being held up in an audit right now.
Okay. Any other questions from my colleagues? Okay, Mr. Pollack.
May it please the court, Nathaniel Pollack representing the United States. I'd like to start with the mandate issue. And the mandate in CSX 1 does not foreclose the government's argument. And the basic reason for that is that this court certainly—
I think your problem is the text, not the mandate.
Okay, well then I can move directly to that, Your Honor. The reason that the text of E1III and Section 162A should be read to correspond, or at least basically correspond to each other, is first that no good reason really to interpret expenses incurred in the business of one's employer, which is E1III, to be a dramatically broader category than expenses incurred in carrying on one's employer's business. And there's very good reasons when you look at the history of E1III to interpret those statutes congruously. And the biggest reason is a reason that really CSX identified in its opening brief, that Congress was responding in enacting E1III to an IRS revenue ruling. The IRS revenue ruling Congress was responding to interpreted the withholding regulation and the prior RRTA regulation differently when it comes to substantiation. It required different substantiation standards for the two regulations, but it interpreted those regulations the same when it comes to the coverage of the business expense carve out from wages in the case of withholding or compensation in the case of the RRTA. And the revenue ruling interpreted both the prior RRTA regulation and the withholding regulation to correspond to Section 162A. So we'd submit that it would be odd, to understate it, for Congress to adopt, in essence, the withholding regulation language in enacting E1-3 to bring the RRTA into alignment with the withholding rules and also FICA, and then have that same language mean something completely different when it became a statute.
It's not the same language, though.
It's true that the word ordinary is dropped and the word allowances is added, but I would point out, Your Honor, that with Congress, the revenue ruling was looking at two regulations, right? And if you look at the old RRTA regulation, what you'll see is that it contains none of the adjectives, not bona fide, not ordinary, not necessary. The language of that old RRTA regulation is just incurred or reasonably expected to be incurred in the business of the employer. So you had different regulatory language, although I would say
but doesn't the omission of the word ordinary, which you concede in E1III, indicate that the two statutes have different meanings? I mean, aren't you asking us to ignore the plain text?
Your Honor, I'm not asking you to ignore the plain text. I think that it's true that the words are different, but they are in terms of the coverage of what they of. At least fundamentally.
Right, but doesn't the omission of the word ordinary, doesn't it imply then that business expenses they constitute different purposes under the two different statutes?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I think that you would have to conclude that there's a material distinction that Congress it meant by dropping the word ordinary to very significantly expand the coverage. And I think if you look at the history of what Congress was doing, how it was reacting to this revenue ruling, in combination with the fact that there's absolutely nothing about this in the legislative history, if you look at legislative history. And also, I think if you look at Wisconsin Central and Luce together, I think what you have is sort of a different in paramatia principle in this context where, yes, certainly under Wisconsin Central, differences in language that are material need require different, you know, interpretations of the statute. But
aren't you asking us really to I mean, I know you're saying something, I think you're saying something different, but aren't you really asking us to expand the use of bona fide and necessary business expense based on language and case law that goes outside the RRTA, when in fact the RRTA really is this separate mechanism that is very narrow and it's very tailored to the railroad industry, which is different than any other industry?
Your Honor, it's certainly true that the RRTA is not always interpreted exactly the same as the other employment tax statutes. I'm not trying to argue against the principle of Wisconsin Central at all, but what I am saying is I think you need to look at you know, here's the sort of historical framework that would be true if Mr. Killian's argument is correct. It's been the case all along since 1930 something, that the RRTA regulation that carves out business expenses was interpreted as it was interpreted in the 1975 revenue ruling to correspond, or at least basically correspond, to Section 162. Then you have, you know, the Congress, you know, obviously by statute, but, you know, superseding that regulation, changing it to different regulation that's modeled after the FICA and withholding language, and making a very minor change, dropping one word and adding another, and saying nothing about that. And then Mr. Killian wants this court to
say nothing about what?
Not stating, at least in the legislative history or anywhere else, you know, what the meaning of that
dropping the word is. They don't have to explain anything in legislative history. They don't vote on legislative
history. Certainly, Your Honor.
Members of Congress rarely even read it. But I mean, the thing they voted on was the statute. We have the words of this statute.
Your Honor, and I don't think the government's argument depends on legislative history, but all I'm saying is if you look
at your argument very much depends on legislative history.
It does not,
it certainly relies on an unstated legislative purpose.
We agree with CSX that Congress was responding to this revenue ruling, and I think that's clear. The issue is you have an existing carve out from compensation for business expenses, and then that carve out is superseded. The regulatory carve out is superseded by statute, but the statute does not on its face expand the coverage of that carve out. I would point out to Your Honor that, I mean, in CSX 1, this court says, you know, expressly that its decision does not mean that the railroad can exclude from compensation anything it deems necessary for its business. But there really is no limiting principle in CSX's argument that, you know, and even if you looked, if you
Tell
were
me this,
obligated.
What kind of moving expenses do you think would be included under your interpretation?
Well, the category of, I mean, certainly, you know, deductible moving expenses are excludable under a different provision. So what we're really talking about here is
I'm talking about E1
Right. So because deductible moving expenses are already excluded under E5, what we're talking about here is relocation benefits. And that's not a statutory category. That's just a descriptive term. And so anything that's a benefit of relocating can be understood as a relocation benefit. We gave an example of the employee that transitions from a situation where they're working in an office to a situation where they're working principally from home. And
what moving expenses are included in your interpretation?
Relocation benefits, I think, are included. The moving expenses that are included are excluded from compensation are the moving expenses that are deductible under Section 217 of the tax code and therefore excluded under Section E5. Okay,
Can you answer the question, which is, what does that entail? Can you give me specifics, please?
Oh, certainly, yes. So under E5, the moving expenses that are included would be all of the direct moving expenses. So the cost of actually transporting a employee's goods, household items from the old residence to the new residence, and also the cost of the employees and the employee's family traveling from the old residence to the new residence, which can include, overnight stays, et cetera. So those are the tax deductible moving expenses that are deductible under Section 217. And those expenses are deductible
from the income tax if the employer incurs it.
But if
the employer provides it and pays for it and exempts that from withholding.
That's appropriate. And CSX did that, and the United States doesn't.
They did that.
You think that
the court, what we have to do is come up with a substantiation requirement from a regulation that's never been written and not give CSX a refund for that amount.
Sorry, Your Honor, I think there's some confusion. Respectfully, the issue of the tax deductible moving expenses that were also, those were also excluded from the RRTA compensation under a different provision. And there's no dispute that those were appropriately excluded by CSX. CSX excluded from withholding, from compensation, RRTA compensation, the tax deductible moving expenses of its employees, and the government does not dispute that. The question is whether additional non-deductible relocation benefits are also excludable under E1III. And I do want to make
one response to it. And I don't understand why they would be. If those are excludable, what would otherwise be deductible expenses if the employee had incurred them? Then what under the language of the statute does not allow the railroad to exclude these others as well?
So
long as they've been
relocation
separately
benefits,
identified.
Relocation benefits that are relocation benefits that are not deductible under any provision of the internal revenue.
What in the statute requires that it be deductible?
It doesn't. The statute doesn't require that. But our position, Your Honor, is that the incurred in the business of the employer taps into regulatory language that has always been read in accordance with Section 162. But I would submit, Your Honor, if you just look at the statute
decision that says that Congress transplanted some language from a regulation into a statute, and that's how we should interpret it.
Your Honor, I mean, I think that the sort
especially
of
when the language is a little different.
I think that the old soil sort of principle is not limited to statutes in the sense that if it's regulatory language,
that your way of
understood
that
what it meant.
Is that your way of saying that the old soil principle has never been applied from the transplanting of regulatory language to a statute so far as you can
tell? I don't have a case at my fingertips on that, Your Honor. But I would just finish by saying, suppose this court doesn't agree with looking at the history of the statute at all. It just looks at the language of Section E13, and it looks at the words incurred in the business of the employer.
Right.
I would submit that a plain language reading of incurred in the business of the employer is in fact actually narrower than Section 162A. And the reason for that is, in the business of the employer suggests that it's actually got to be something that you're doing in furtherance of the employer's business.
Okay.
So something like, paying an employer shipping costs out of pocket and being reimbursed, that would clearly be in the business of the employer. But, one's meal expenses, those are deductible under 162A and under certain circumstances. But it's not clear to me that if you just, you know, wash everything away and look at the text of the statute, that meal expenses would really be understood to be in the business of the employer. And so I would submit that this broad but-for causation argument that CSX uses, that anything that any expense that is incurred that wouldn't have been incurred but for my employment, that's an extremely broad standard that I don't think is suggested by the plain language of the statute in the business of the employer. So I suppose I will just respectfully ask this court not to become the first court to interpret this 1976 statute modeled on regulatory language that goes all the way back to the 1940s to cover a broad array of non-deductible relocation benefits. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Pollack, we have your argument. Mr. Killian, you've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start where Mr. Pollack ended. I think any trier of fact can reasonably distinguish between a move that was done for personal reasons and a move that was done because the employer said, I want you to move so you can keep your job. This is not sort of an unlimited interpretation of E1III. Mr. Pollack and Judge Lagoa talked about some of the language differences between E1III and 162A. I also would point out that E1III is not limited to expenses incurred in the business of the employer, but also covers expenses reasonably expected to be incurred in the business of the employer. 162A requires that it actually be incurred. E1III has a prospective looking effect as well. And so it makes sense that they're different. Mr. Pollack said that the link between these exclusions and 162A goes back to the 1930s. But the only thing he cited for that in his brief and today is the revenue ruling that the IRS issued in 1974-5 that precipitated E1III to overturn it. While that revenue ruling did talk about deductibility principles, 2 years later, the Supreme Court in Central Illinois reversed that. It was the same principle in that 1974-75 revenue ruling that Central Illinois, the Supreme Court, reversed in 1978. So that link really wasn't there, notwithstanding what the revenue ruling says. Mr. Pollack asks whether there's a limiting principle to our interpretation of E1III. Yes, you apply the plain text. And as the district court found on remand, for example, the home sale bonuses that CSX provided to its employees were not reimbursements, advances, and allowances. We failed the form requirement for those types of payments. So this is not some sort of open-ended exclusion that a company like CSX can use for anything it wants, as Mr. Pollack threatens. This court asked Mr. Pollack to identify an example of a true moving expense that would fit within his interpretation of E1III, and he was able to identify none. And the reason that is, as we explained in our reply brief, and Mr. Pollack again avoided mentioning today, is that since 1970, the IRS has had a regulation that says you may not use 162A for moving expenses. It's not that the language of 162A is somehow incompatible with using it for business required moving expenses. It says because the IRS, by sheer force of will, has forbidden individuals and employers from using 162A for moving expenses. And that's ultimately what this argument is all about. The IRS is trying to do bootstrapping. It has this regulation that carves moving expenses out of 162A, and by hocus pocus, wants that regulation to carve moving expenses out of E1III. But as the Supreme Court noted in Wisconsin Central, the Railroad Retirement Tax Act is unique. And when it has unique language as E1III is, it, quote, requires respect, not disregard. The IRS could not adopt a regulation that carves moving expenses directly out of E1III. The court should not let them accomplish that indirectly by this 162A deductibility requirement. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Killian. We have your case, and we'll move to the second case.